From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
with just over a week before Election Day, early voting is underway in Arkansas and at quite a high pace.
But the Arkansas Supreme Court says votes for one medical marijuana proposal will not count.
We'll also take a closer look at two other items on the ballot, issues 1 and 3.
An Arkansas lawmaker proposed a $105 million income tax cut for the upcoming session of the legislature. Who gets it and who pays for it?
And in an early sign of budget battles to come, the governor aims to cut funding for Little Rock's War Memorial Stadium.
For the week ending Friday, October 28th, 2016, this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
That's just ahead. Well, it seems like the current election season has been dragging on for years, and I guess the presidential race, the campaigning really has been going on for at least a year and a half. But finally, the end is in sight. And this week, on Monday, early voting began in Arkansas. I caught up with a few voters who cast ballots on that first day at the Pulaski County Regional Building, like Paul Sillman.
I have a pretty busy schedule. Didn't think I'd be able to come out any other time, so today seemed like a good opportunity.
How did you feel about this election?
It was a hot mess, quite frankly. So can't wait for it to be over.
And that was a pretty consistent theme I heard over and over from voters just saying they're ready for this to be done. Candace Bozeman of Jacksonville said she wanted to make sure she found time to vote, getting out there on that first day, saying that the stakes are extremely high.
I think it's going to be pretty big for my children's future. I have 12-year-old kids, so this is going to pretty much, this election is going to determine the next 4 or 5 years, possibly 8 years. So I just felt it was important for me to make sure that my voice is heard in this year's election.
Another voter here in Little Rock was Pam Hinlein, who was very excited to be there.
I couldn't wait another second. Just couldn't. Enough is enough for hearing it all. Now I can just turn everything off.
Ready to have this behind you.
I am. And I'm so happy to be here voting for the first female president.
It's very dramatic, and I wish everybody to come out and vote because we need to speak for not just ourselves but for the whole country. We need to have someone in office that is actually for us and trying to work for the better of the good to make America really great again.
And that final voter was Lyness Wesley. Early voting will continue until Monday, November 7th. But there are concerns, fears from many of perhaps voter intimidation, or even there's been talk of possible violence at the polls, at least officials wanting to make sure that they're ready for anything. And on Monday, the U.S. attorneys for the Eastern and Western districts of Arkansas named representatives of their offices who will oversee the handling of any complaints about election fraud or voting rights abuses. So we'll see how this actually plays out. But also, I'm sure we'll have a lot of campaign representatives who will be monitoring the election process. And it looks like it's going to come down to, as was expected, these handful of battleground states. In particular, Florida has gotten a lot of attention so far from the candidates.
I'll just say, I mean, aside from concerns about potential issues like voter fraud, I know this election is expected to have some of the highest turnout of more recent modern presidential elections. I think earlier in the week, or perhaps it was last week, the Arkansas Secretary of State's office predicted that nearly 70% of Arkansas registered voters would turn out. And earlier today, as we record this, I was speaking with Brian Pose, the director of elections for Pulaski County. And he said they've already seen at least a higher turnout in early voting so far than they did in the 2012 presidential election. So I think a lot of people, no matter what side of the aisle, what political persuasion you're on, I think a lot of people view this election as being one of very high stakes.
And I think most of that talk of voter fraud, it almost all comes down to Donald Trump saying the election's going to be rigged, and then various people throughout the country kind of reiterating that there could be some fraud. We've heard reports on NPR all week investigating voter fraud in past elections as perhaps an indicator of what it could be like this time. They've virtually said in-person voter fraud, which is talked about all the time, would be virtually impossible. There's very few cases, and basically they said if you want to steal an election, it's a very dumb strategy to do it. So you have to have an equal amount of people to actually go in to do it. So the real issue, which Michael mentioned, is voting rights abuse, about people who want to vote who aren't allowed to vote. That's like a more realistic possibility of happening.
Yeah, and I'll refer back to that conversation I had earlier with Brian Poe. He said, you know, they typically encounter a fair amount of issues each election, in terms of like people just going to their polls and maybe their address is different than it's listed, you know, mm-hmm. and or, you know, maybe they're not on the register or something, or there's some issue, and they have an appeals process, and where the director of elections and the Pulaski County or the election commission for the county has a process in which, you know, they determine whether or not, you know, a voter should cast a provisional ballot that will be reviewed later, after the election, or whether, you know, they're in fact registered or they've gone through the regular process. So, and he said they typically, in a presidential election at least, they encounter a few hundred people who actually, you know, might have an issue, some kind of registration issue that they might encounter in the process. So, I mean, something along those lines is probably more likely than any kind of fraud.
Well, one item that will not be counted will be votes for Issue 7, one of two medical marijuana proposals on the November ballot. The Arkansas Supreme Court on Thursday cited problems with how some petition signatures were gathered, invalidated, I think about 12,000, and so that will not be, it will be on the ballot, but votes won't be counted. What was the reaction you found, Chris?
Oh, well, I mean, I spoke with, a UCA political science professor yesterday, Heather Yates, and, you know, I think, her main point was that this the Supreme Court and their decision invalidating the signatures on this are several thousand, I think 12,000 signatures on the petition for the Arkansas Medical Cannabis Act to get on the ballot. They cited a 2013 state law that regulates the petition gathering process with particular attention on, you know, paid canvassers. And, I think she said, and I think a lot of other people I've, you know, heard from have said that, you know, this law has really, you know, not exactly, well, I guess you could say stymied a lot of, attempts at, you know, citizen-driven initiative kind of measures. But it's really been shown to have a lot of political and legal teeth, I think was her words, and just showing how stringent of, you know, measures that, you know, people who are canvassers and campaigners for a citizen initiated ballot issue, you know, what they have to go through in order to get something on the ballot. It's become increasingly more difficult in the state, and, you know, I think this ruling, it goes along with, you know, some other rulings by the, you know, state Supreme Court this year, invalidating based on a separate kind of issue, the, you know, for casinos, for instance, or, you know, some tort reform measure. The issue in those cases wasn't signature validity, but it kind of shows you how much the Supreme Court is entangled in these electoral issues, which seems to be increasingly more common.
And even though they withdrew 12,000 signatures, they had three or four different reasons for why. And with that, when they withdrew all those, it fell about 2,400 signatures short, the 67,000 needed. So it was just a really narrow margin. And of course, the reason why is at the state Supreme Court is because a special master had previously found only 2,000 or so signatures should be disqualified, which would have kept it on the ballot. So it's kind of an interesting split right there as well. But the takeaway for me to this about this decision is those 12,000 people who signed the petition that they wanted it to be on the ballot, nothing was wrong with them necessarily. Mm-hmm. They signed their name to it, and they are registered voters. The problem was just that, in theory, one of these paid canvassers might have tried to mislead someone or not let them read it. But there, of course, there's no proof of any of that. So,
yeah, and this is a kind of a similar issue that happened earlier this year with county petition drives to get alcohol, wet dry questions mm-hmm. on the ballot. The issue was relating to a separate state law passed in 2015, but in several cases like Randolph County, Johnson County, and a couple other places, these petition drives had gathered enough signatures, but they failed to sign their name the right way on the petition page, or maybe one signature out of several on a petition page was invalid, and that disqualified the whole page. Right. And so it was this issue where, these people who signed the petition, clearly wanted the issue on the ballot, but because of the language of this law that was written, they can't.
Yeah. Well, I was at the Capitol in, I think it was June, when Melissa Foltz, who's the one behind Issue 7, arrived with her box loads of petitions. And I don't remember how many, but I think she said she had something in the range of like 30,000 above what was the required number. And it shows just how many can easily be found to be invalid, because that seemed almost astronomical. You'll definitely make it on the ballot, but you can find narrow issues with the laws now that can enable this many to be knocked off.
One of the issues where some paid canvassers are required to get background checks from the state police, and many of them did, but maybe they only did it after they collected the signatures before they turned it in, so they didn't do it in the right order of things. So that was one issue. Some paid canvassers, they weren't paid until towards the end of the drive, because the organizer said, well, we have some extra campaign money, let's give it to the people that helped us. Well, okay, now all of their signatures are discounted. And about 3,000, which would have been enough to keep it on the ballot, were discounted because canvassers didn't give a residential address, but they might have given their business address if they owned a business, or a P.O. box, but that didn't meet the standard either. So that's issue 7, and that was it would have had some limited cultivation for certain patients. It would have been regulated by the State Department of Health and had nonprofit dispensaries. The one that's still on the ballot that people can vote for, which of course looks like it has a better shot now. Issue 6, it's a constitutional amendment regulated by the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission with several for-profit dispensaries and more limited amount of patients. But a state representative who is opposed to both of them offered a third option, perhaps in the future. At a press conference opposing these two measures, State Representative Dan Douglas of Northwest Arkansas, a Republican, he came up to the electorate and said, well, some of my colleagues didn't really want me to say this today, but I'm going to try to introduce legislation next January. They would have a very much more restricted version of medical marijuana or medical cannabis. And here's Dan Douglas kind of describing his solution, how it's different.
Normal marijuana, to my understanding, is about 10% THC. This low THC, it specifies in the bill the variety cannabis, sativa, and it is less than 0.5%. So you see, and it has to be over 10% CBD or cannabinol. And so that's the medical part. So that way you get the best of both worlds. Nobody wants to smoke it because you don't get high, unless you truly are sick and having seizures, and you can give it in a liquid form or an oil or whatever.
So fewer conditions would be covered, fewer treatment options. This is still in a draft form. There's no indication if this will ever make it out of committee or if anybody really supports it yet at this point. So I asked Dan Douglas why him. It's kind of unusual that this like conservative Republican wants to be the medical marijuana guy.
I imagine like you didn't grow up thinking one day I'm going to be the guy in the legislature.
No. I've tongue-in-cheek been referred to as a highwayman because of my passion for highway funding. Now they're saying, oh, you are the highway man, you know. Didn't expect to be the marijuana legislator, but, it, you know, it is an issue.
So good sense of humor about it now. I guess if it ever passes, it could be an issue, I'm sure, in a Republican primary that you helped legalize medical marijuana in some way. One of the big questions is, how serious is he about this? Will it ever pass, or is it just kind of like a ploy to get people to not vote for issue six? Just hold out for me.
I certainly hope that people will know that whenever I give my word I'm going to do something, I will do it. I know that I'm not a crook, has been you know, used too many times. But I have every intention. I've got the draft language or the draft bill already drafted. So we'll just work with everybody in the medical community and law enforcement and the agencies that would administer the program, and we'll go from there. But I will file the bill, and I feel confident. I really do. That a responsible bill can pass in the Arkansas legislature.
So we'll see if this gains any traction at all. The governor's office had some really tepid comments about it, saying he hasn't really looked at it, but, you know, he'll consider it. But the main objection all along has been that we can't have medical marijuana because it hasn't gone through the FDA. Well, Dan Douglas's bill would not go through the FDA either. It's based on some more restrictive Texas law. And some of these ballot groups, Issue 6 and Issue 7, they responded to his plan saying, one, it's a distraction meant to make you not vote for these issues, thinking there might be a legislative solution later, and two, that this low THC, high CBD concoction is only meant for a limited range of illnesses like seizures and wouldn't help with 30 other odd problems.
Well, we'll come back to one other election, or actually two other election-related items, and those are issues 1 and 3 toward the end of the podcast. But staying on the topic of the legislature, we did have one state lawmaker this week propose a tax cut of his own. This Bart Hester, a Republican from Northwest Arkansas, said, and you'll hear it in my conversation with him here, but that he was concerned that he hadn't heard anything from Governor Hutchinson yet. Hutchinson last year proposed a big tax cut package that went through, and it's expected that he will. But Jacob, why do you think he's, I mean, there's nothing indicating that the governor won't actually come through with something.
Well, I don't know, I guess, his motivation. He obviously wants to influence the conversation. He sees it not happening right now. So if he comes out with this release, then now the public has some expectation that this is a possibility. So I guess he's just trying to throw himself out there as a high-profile legislator with a plan. Bart Hester has sought public attention for whatever reason on various occasions, a number of high-profile bills. Most recently, he switched his vote, sort of, or did like the ha-ha line item veto vote for Medicaid expansion. That was a big deal for the governor that he voted that way for the governor. So I don't think there's animosity between them. I'm sure the governor's plan will take total priority over Bart Hester's plan. And
well,
November 1st or 8th, I think, is when the governor's budget's supposed to be delivered.
Well, we have seen money revenue for the state not coming in at levels projected, so there may not be as much money as had been proposed, but I still can't imagine the governor not proposing that plan.
Yeah, that's what House leadership has, and the governor have continuously said when asked about what their tax cut plan is going to be. They say, we want to wait till closer till we have the latest budget numbers, and that's because the budget numbers don't really look good for this. What's Bart Hester's solution to filling the gap? One, he thinks smaller government is good inherently. Two, here's a quote from him, I'm ever optimistic about the future of our great state. I'm also optimistic that our state's fiscal outlook will start to show significant positive growth in the coming months. With this optimism in mind, I'm proposing my income tax reductions. So that's his plan to fill the budget goal, is he's optimistic that growth will materialize that will then get back into state revenue.
Well, here's my interview with Hester from Wednesday's All Things Considered.
Ultimately, the goal is to have an impact on all Arkansans, but, you know, with being able to say that, hey, if your gross income is $21,000 or less, You know, I don't think you should be paying income tax in Arkansas. You're certainly paying grocery taxes and sales taxes and certainly doing your part. But we wanted to make an impact on that group first and foremost.
And this would also involve some cuts for people making between $30,000 and $50,000.
Well, that's right. It would be a 1% cut for those making $30,000 or $50,000. I'd use the example of your first year school teachers or your police officers making in that range. Like those are the people we want to back up and we want to support them. And an income tax for that group again is something we should be looking forward to doing. You know, that alone would affect like 170,000 Arkansans in that bracket alone.
What went into preparing this plan? What was the thinking here of what you wanted to accomplish?
Well, really, it wasn't the overall number. You know, I wasn't necessarily looking for $100 million, even though it came out about there. I really just started asking questions of the Department of Finance and Administration on if we lowered, you know, this bracket by this percentage, how much does each percentage cost me? You know, and the biggest buy was the higher earners, you know, people making $75,000 or more. If you drop them by a tenth of a percent from 6.9 to 6.8, that's like a $20 to $25 million price tag per year in the state of Arkansas. So, you know, I would have loved to have taken that down a lot more. The price tag was just too big. But to be brief on answering your question, I started off by figuring out how much each percentage cost and each to cut, and then I worked back from there.
The governor has had his own tax cuts last year, approving $102 million, and has said he'll propose another income tax cut this coming year. Will this compete with his, or will they work together? What will happen to decide which cuts get to be made?
Well, I would say we're going to work together on it, and you can't figure out what you want to do until someone starts laying out a plan. And I started getting nervous thinking, here we are at the end of October going into session in January, and I'm not seeing any plans. And the intent with mine is to say, hey guys, here's what I'm working on. Now if you want to come and say you want to change mine by doing this, or here's your plan, I'm happy to look at your plan. I just think the people of Arkansas deserve a little tax break. You know, we did some last session. I want to do it this session. I want to do it again next session. As we become more fiscally responsible as a state, we can give the taxpayers back some more of their money. I fully expect to work with the House and the governor on what we choose to do.
And have you had a chance to talk with your fellow lawmakers yet to determine whether or not this looks likely to get passage?
I am getting a lot of support. What I am getting from a lot of my colleagues is fully in support of income tax cut. Not sure that your amounts are right. Not sure that I want to do it exactly like you want to do it. And I say, great, that was the impetus for me releasing this today to really start the conversation, and let's see what we can do to get a majority of the legislature to support. You know, you're never going to find something when you're cutting taxes that you're going to get 80 or 90% approval on. We need 51% in the House and Senate and a governor's signature, and that's what we're going to work towards.
So we'll see what happens with his proposal. Meanwhile, we had another potential issue that will be debated in the coming session with the budget. And, Jacob, that's the governor and his proposal to cut funding for War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock.
Yeah, the stadium only gets about $900,000 or so, which is a drop in the bucket in the state budget. It's like nothing almost. And if you think about the $100 million football stadium expansion in Fayetteville, what's $900,000? Nothing. But apparently, to War Memorial, it is like almost everything. They really say they really need it, and that there aren't private donors out there like there are for other regular football stadiums. So the governor, he wants to cut it in half by 2018. And so that vote has been kicked all the way down to 2018. So who knows what will develop between now and 18 in terms of if that budget gets cut or not. But here's the governor's main argument for why he thinks it should be cut. The other big move this week is he would move it away from an independent 8-member commission that reports to him to putting it under the Department of Parks and Tourism.
It's just simply a matter of managing state government and managing the agencies. And I looked at War Memorial Stadium, and first of all, when I realized it's a direct report to me, that it's not any broader part of my cabinet, I said they need more guidance, they need more support, they need more strength. Secondly, I've been looking at it for, you know, a year and a half as to, you know, their budget and looking at it historically. And historically, War Memorial Stadium has operated without any general revenues. And that changed about 2006. And so I wanted to fully fund them the first year of the biennium. And then I wanted to start on the path of self-sufficiency. And this is a reasonable way to do it whenever the second year the general revenue portion is cut simultaneously with the bond payment being foregone and concluded. And then thirdly, we have this initiative with Parks and Tourism, as well as the independent stadium consultant. All of that tied together, this is good management. This ultimately sets the goal of a self-sustaining War Memorial Stadium as it has been historically.
And Kane Webb, who's the director of the Department of Parks and Tourism, the new director, and he's a former sports writer, so he cares about War Memorial for personal reasons. And he is also friends of this guy, Rex Nelson, who's like everywhere all the time.
A local mover and shaker.
Yeah, in sports and politics. Rex Nelson has big designs that he's put in the paper for a post-Razorbacks War Memorial Stadium. They would basically be all about youth activities and sports. But anyway, here's Kane Webb saying why he thinks the Parks and Tourism Department is a good fit.
It's pretty exciting for an old sports writer like me. It's exciting. I think it's also a really good fit for the Department of Parks and Tourism. It's in our wheelhouse. It's what we do. We're in the hospitality and tourism business. We run facilities. We put on events. We serve the public, and we know how to get the good word out about Arkansas and its many attractions. I also think it's a real compliment to the competence and ability of our coworkers at the agency at Parks and Tourism. We have an established record of getting things done, taking care of business, of doing right by the taxpayers, the citizens of Arkansas, and our guests. And our team is ready for this challenge. I had a small group go out and meet with Jerry the other day, Friday morning. Man, they speak the same language. It just seems like a really, really natural fit for us. I really like the idea of the governor's feasibility study. It always helps to have an objective outside look at something, especially when it comes to this something, which is such an emotional and cultural touchstone for so many of us in Arkansas. And I know this is about the future, but not the past. And I know that numbers have been driving this story. I understand that. But, you know, on a personal note, I love War Memorial Stadium.
So there we go. And this is the last cut. It's the governor's kind of commenting loosely on what he believes the future of War Memorial might hold. For the record, he says he would like the Razorbacks to play another game there a year.
With the sports emphasis that we have in Arkansas, the incredible athletic teams, that there will be sports teams that want to build a following in Central Arkansas, and there's opportunities for that. So I think there'll be a lot of discussions as we continue to make War Memorial Stadium strong as to who wants to seize those opportunities for a Central Arkansas market. And whenever you see two high school teams play with 31,000 in the stands at War Memorial Stadium, clearly there will be higher level sports at the collegiate level that will want to utilize the incredible fan base here in Central Arkansas.
But there's always the argument that War Memorial is outdated as a venue, you know, in this era of luxury skyboxes. And even though they did, I think, an $11 million renovation back 2009, 2010, the Razorbacks still barely play there. And it's mainly used, and they say what it's used, you know, high school games, and you know, important in that respect.
Food festivals,
the Jewish food festival, and the Little Rock Rangers, the minor league soccer team is now playing games there.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like they just are wrapping up the big renovation of Robinson Auditorium, and I'll have a story for next week on that. But this $68 million renovation where they completely gutted it, because in this era, venues that were built in the 1930s or so just aren't really seen as modern, and you have teams like the Razorbacks not really eager to use it.
At the same time, like, if they made War Memorial into like a 80,000 seat stadium like they have in Fayetteville, it just wouldn't get filled. You know, it's part of it is there's not a real team here. UALR is not going to have a football team, and if they do, they would not sell out War Memorial. So
it's been a conundrum for quite a few.
But also,
years,
it's, you know, like it's in the Parks Department now too. It's not an expectation of almost any stadium or park that they're self-sufficient. So it's like an unconventional precedent to set that this one needs to be self-sufficient. That's not a normal thing.
Well, finally, on the back to the election underway now, Chris, you put together two profiles of issues 1 and 3. You want to give a brief setup? I guess let's start with issue 3.
First of all, you should know, you know, every legislative session, the legislature and votes to approve three resolutions that will be proposed constitutional amendments that will go on the following year's general election ballot. And in 2015, the legislature again approved three. And one of them, as you said, issue 3, the ballot title for that one is concerning, let's see, was it job creation, job expansion, and economic development, which sounds very vague. And part of the reason why I did these is to just kind of flesh out exactly all the parts to them. And here we have issue 3. One of the primary provisions of the proposed constitutional amendment in issue 3 would allow the legislature to approve an unlimited amount of bond money to support new large-scale economic development projects. Those could include new manufacturing facilities or corporate headquarters. Supporters argue the measure would untie the hands of the state, making it a more attractive location for companies looking to expand. Joe Bailey, a member of the committee Jobs for Arkansas, which supports the amendment, says it would allow the state to better compete with its neighbors.
Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, skip over to Alabama, Georgia, sometimes Missouri, a lot of times Tennessee. Projects that are looking in the southern region are who we normally are competing with. And those states, by and large, have the ability to issue bonds, to borrow funding without any limits in order to put an incentive package on the table.
Amendment 82 of the Arkansas Constitution, approved by voters in 2004, currently limits economic development bonds the state can issue to 5% of general revenue. The proposed amendment would do away with that cap. The proposal would also allow local governments, like cities and counties, to appropriate funds to private entities that promote job creation, like regional chambers of commerce. Again, Bailey says this provision is about competition.
9 times out of 10, the local community in other states is able to put more on the table than our communities are. I can't speak to every community in all of those states as to what they do and do not have in terms of incentives, but I know that historically, we just have not been competitive locally.
Last year, a Pulaski County Circuit Judge ordered the cities of North Little Rock and Little Rock to stop making payments to local chambers of commerce because the practice violated the state constitution. Jim Lynch, the lead plaintiff in that lawsuit, considers the once annual payments to have been, in his words, corporate welfare. He says taxpayer money used in the name of economic development could be more effective going to fund workforce training or technical programs at public schools.
But what we're talking about now is just giving away money, just giving away cash, public cash, to help finance a business that may or may not be well managed, that may or may not make good on its ability to pay back bonds.
The decision in Lynch's lawsuit would be rendered moot if voters pass issue 3. Lynch says other provisions of the proposed amendment are also concerning because of the potential for state and local governments to divert more revenue toward companies or individuals and away from traditional services.
Of course, they're selling jobs, jobs, jobs. And of course, that's important to the public, but it shouldn't be competing with teacher salaries, salaries for policemen, firemen, and so forth.
But Joe Bailey of the group Jobs for Arkansas says the proposed amendment is about striking a balance with public funding. And right now, he says state and local governments do not have that balance.
My opinion is that there is not a better investment in your community or state than putting money towards infrastructure that will create higher paying and better jobs and opportunities for people who are unemployed or underemployed to move into a better job.
Issue 3 has garnered relatively little organized opposition, but filings with the State Ethics Commission show that Bailey's committee, Jobs for Arkansas, has so far spent more than $250,000 on an ad campaign using contributions from regional chambers of commerce, private businesses, and the Arkansas Economic Development Foundation in support of the proposal. Chris Hickey, KUAR News.
All right, there's issue 3. And Chris, you also produced a look at issue 1.
Issue 1 is an amendment concerning the terms, election, and eligibility of elected officials in the state. Now, this primarily has to do with county elected officials. So here's the report. The proposed constitutional amendment would primarily extend terms from 2 to 4 years for certain county elected officials. Those affected would include sheriffs, county judges, assessors, clerks, treasurers, coroners, and surveyors. Supporters of the proposal say under the current 2-year terms, incumbents devote too much time to campaigning for office, and Baxter County Sheriff John Montgomery says that time could be better spent on performing necessary administrative duties.
When you have to run for office every 2 years, basically you're running for office for a year and then you're in office for a year. And so it's very disruptive to the office. It's disruptive to the employees in that office. And I think it puts a tremendous extra workload on those folks. In the case of the sheriff, obviously, we're dealing with public safety. So many times when we're out maybe campaigning, we have to drive separate vehicles. We have to respond back to emergencies 24/7. So it's very, very cumbersome.
Montgomery is the director and chairman of the Coalition for Election Reform, a committee supportive of Issue 1. Committee member and Pulaski County Treasurer Deborah Buckner says the current 2-year terms give rise to instability.
If we need new software, but we're not maybe going to be in office long enough to see it implemented and the cost efficiencies realized, it's difficult to take bold steps to do better governing because we may not even be here to complete the task.
Issue 1 also clarifies the state definition of what's called an infamous crime to being a felony, abuse of office, tampering, or a misdemeanor offense of deceit or fraud. An infamous crime conviction prevents electability to office in the state. The measure also stipulates that certain county candidates who run unopposed for their seats would not have their names appear on the ballot. Supporters argue this would save money in the election process. Finally, Issue 1 also prohibits county elected officials from holding another civil office, like positions of city attorney, alderman, or a place on some governing board or commission. Buckner calls this provision an ethics reform.
Having public office holders being appointed to civil service positions, there's always that hint or possibility, and frankly, history has shown us conflict of interest.
One opposition committee is Arkansas for Free Enterprise, formed by the conservative advocacy group Conduit for Action. Brenda Vassar-Taylor is a part of both groups. She pushes back against the argument that 2 years is not enough time to carry out essential duties in county roles.
Anyone that can look at the job descriptions of these county officials, not that they're not significant, but they don't rise to the occasion to need 4 years to figure out your job description and do a good job. Government closest to the people is always going to be the best government.
Taylor considers the current 2-year terms necessary for holding officials accountable, but Buckner counters that any accountability concerns should be weighed against the efficiencies that could result from the longer terms.
Are you going to have a bad apple from time to time? Well, of course, there's bad apples in every profession. But on balance, in today's world of technology and the rapid pace, it just makes sense to gain some stability at the local level.
Arkansas for Free Enterprise has not begun an extensive campaign against Issue 1. The committee in support of the measure, the Coalition for Election Reform, has raised a little over $23,000, but has mostly spent it on legal, accounting, and consulting fees. Chris Hickey, KUAR News.
All right. Well, thank you for that look at Issue 1.
You heard in there a mention of the clarification on language regarding infamous crimes. And what I didn't include in the report is one of the reasons why an infamous crime conviction is being clarified, which, you know, as you heard in the report, infamous crime prevents an elected official from maintaining office if they're convicted of one. Back in 2013, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but there was a Searcy County sheriff elected, And during the campaign, this issue came up with him back in the late 70s. As a young man, he was accused of and charged and convicted of stealing chickens. And the opponents in that race, challenged his election results based on this language of the infamous crime, preventing one from seeking office. They took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, indeed, it has to be removed from office because he was convicted of stealing chickens back in the late 70s. So part of the reason why the infamous crime language is in here is to kind of make it more specific to, I guess, abuse of office or, like a felony offense, which stealing chickens was not.
Yeah, stealing chickens and infamous.
Yeah,
I'm sure at one time in Arkansas that was a priority for the legislature to enact laws. But we did get some polling this week, Jacob. I don't have it right in front of me, but basically these issues, they've been low profile, and a lot more people really don't know anything about them. So whether or not these issues get support.
Yeah, I also don't have the polling in front of me, but I think, Chris, we can all try to figure out if our memories work. Issues 1 and 3, it seemed like there's about 30% for, 30% against, and about 30% that they didn't know at all. And there's not any like tremendous marketing campaigns from either one, so voters are going to have to look for it if they want to know.
Yeah, that's true. There really hasn't been. I mean, we've talked extensively about other ballot issues, the citizen-driven ballot issues this election, but relatively little has been said about these. If you want to know more, you can, look at our website, but, also the University of Arkansas Extension Service Public Policy Center has voter guides detailing what each issue does, and they give, arguments for and against. I've looked at them, and it's relatively unbiased, assessment of an analysis of what each issue does. So if you need more information, go there.
All right. Well, with that, we'll wrap up. Thanks for listening to KUAR's Weekend Review podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. KUAR is a listener-supported, editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and if you do, we'll see you next week, or we'll talk with you next week.